Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, should parks be managed by the government or by the people who live in and around them? In the Brazilian Amazon, a new park puts the control in the hands of the people who live there. But in this country, control has always remained with the government, and some people are trying to change that. We'll hear a debate over the issue. Then most Americans say they're concerned about the environment, but many don't know how to put their beliefs into action. We visit a new campaign where neighbors teach each other how to be good stewards. Natural landscapers say American lawn mania is a threat to the environment and wildlife. We'll tell you about how you can bring nature closer to home. And in our Earth calendar, we meet some clever rats who plant seeds in the Arizona desert and communicate by stamping their feet. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. A new reserve, the size of the state of Connecticut, has been established in the Amazon River Basin in Brazil. The reserve aims to balance the needs of the forest with those of the 4,000 people who have lived there for as long as anyone can remember. Dr. John Robinson is a vice president at the Wildlife Conservation Society, which led the drive to establish the reserve.
The area is called Mamirawa, and it's about 1.4 million hectares, right bang in the middle of the Amazon basin. It's an area where the Juruá and the Amazon Solimões rivers come together. It's just basically a big triangle. And the area is really a whole series of lakes and rivers and forests, lagoons, basically built up from sedimentation of those rivers as they come into this whole area.
Each year, the rivers rise about 50 feet, flooding nearly all parts of the forest. The indigenous people put their houses and livestock on floating platforms and get around during the floods in canoes. When the floods recede, the forest is renewed and becomes incredibly productive. The threat to Mamirawa comes from unsustainable logging and agriculture, which have leveled other areas of the Amazon River Basin. Robinson says that with Mamirawa, the Wildlife Conservation Society is trying to do things differently.
When we conservationists began thinking about conserving the flooded forest, we really didn't have very much of a clue on how to do it. And what happened was that a group of researcher scientists who were fisheries people, who were terrestrial ecologists, who were foresters, that really asked the questions, what can this area produce? What do people need? What is the economic and social system here? And so what this is doing is it's recognizing that perhaps the best way to manage these areas are to turn over the responsibility of managing those resources to the people that are living there and empowering them, giving them backup.
Robinson is optimistic. He says many countries don't devote enough resources to properly manage parks, and as a result, the ecosystems continue to decline. But with the support and vigilance of the indigenous people, the hope is that people can be a component of a sustainable future. You're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or hear any of our last four shows via the Internet. Go to our webpage at www.wamc.org/env and click on Listen to the Environment Show. That's www.wamc.org/env. And now it's time for Locking Horns, an Environment Show debate. While residents in the Brazilian rainforest will manage the Mamirawa Reserve, residents in and near this country's national parks do not have a say in their management. National parks in the U.S. Virgin Islands, South Dakota, Arizona, and Minnesota are all facing campaigns from localities who want a greater say in their management. A bill before Congress would allow localities around Voyageurs National Park in northern Minnesota to control how it is run. Joining us are Lori Nelson, Heartland Regional Director of the National Parks and Conservation Association, and Minnesota State Senator Bob Lessard, who is chairman of Minnesota's Environment and Natural Resources Committee. They lock horns over the question, should local interests have more input and more authority in decision-making process in the management of the Voyageurs National Park? Ms. Nelson.
No. Changing the law to hand over Voyageurs or any other national park to local control chips away at the foundation upon which a national park system was built. The purpose of the national park system is to manage national parks so that they may be enjoyed by future generations, insulated from purely local whims. Today, each of our national parks is held to a consistently high standard of management. Local interests are given ample opportunity to participate in park management decisions. However, local interests must be balanced with the need to preserve these national treasures for you and me. It's unrealistic to expect local governments to shoulder the responsibility of ensuring that the national interest is representative. Let's not take the national out of Voyageurs National Park.
Senator Lessard.
The point is this, that absolutely, if you look at the history of the Voyageurs National Park, two of the individuals that were involved envisioned the park as a multiple-use park. In fact, if you go back to the original legislation that was introduced by Congressman Blatnick, it allowed for hunting in the Voyageurs National Park, which was subsequently stripped away after the enactment of the legislation. What we're asking here in northern Minnesota is not, and I don't disagree with saying that will somehow work to the detriment of the park, is more voice into the implementation of the rules. What has happened up in northern Minnesota is we've had restriction after restriction after restriction that have gone into direct contrary to the original legislation. I can give an example. Just a few months ago, out of the blue came a provision that
Senator,
they were going
afraid,
to enact.
I'm afraid your time is up.
Okay.
Ms. Nelson, then reply.
Yes, I think Senator Lessard overstates what the true intention of Voyageurs National Park was. It was intended to be a wilderness park. It was also intended to be a motorized park, but the two were intended to be balanced. The uses are currently balanced. We think that the Park Service has provided ample opportunity for local people to participate in the decision-making process. We agree that there should be local input. We don't think there should be local control.
Thank you.
And that
Senator Lessard, the last word, 20 seconds.
I just want to jump in here a little bit. The fact of the matter is the promises that were given in the establishment of the Voyageurs National Park said that there would be input by the local people. It hasn't happened. We've had restriction after restriction after restriction, and all we're asking is more input in the decision-making process. That's all the bill does, both in the House and the United States Senate.
Thank
and
you
I cannot
both.
See why they should object to that.
Thank you both. We've been joined by Lori Nelson from the National Parks and Conservation Association and Senator Bob Lessard from the State Senate in Minnesota. The quality of our environment is heavily impacted by daily decisions we make as individuals. Polls tell us that a lot of people are concerned about the environment, but they also tell us that people don't know how to make their lives more environmentally friendly. A new program called EcoTeam is working toward changing people's habits to improve the environment and to save money. Stephanie Goichman reports.
The desire to conserve energy, reduce waste, and preserve natural resources is present. Many people are eager to do their part, but often don't know how. So David Gershon, president of the not-for-profit organization Global Action Plan in Woodstock, New York, decided to help people turn their awareness into everyday practice. He created a national community-based campaign designed to empower people to live environmentally friendly lifestyles.
Well, the program is divided up into six action areas: reducing waste, water efficiency, energy efficiency, transportation efficiency, eco-wise consuming, and then empowering others to also participate. You need about five or six households to do it. It takes 4 months. It's 8 meetings. You meet every 2 weeks. So someone from the team facilitates each meeting. The meetings take about an hour and a half. And there's a voluntary coach, someone who's been on through the program somewhere in the country, who helps the neighborhood teams be successful, and they're trained by us. So that's the basic process of how you would start a team. Cost $35. The process is very simple. It's somewhat elegant because it doesn't demand a lot. At the same time, the kinds of results that people have are very significant. On average, each household that goes through the program reduces what they send into the solid waste stream by 42%, and the amount of water they use by 26%, and the amount of energy they use by 15%. And the amount of CO2 emissions by 16, and they are saving an average of about $400.
According to Gershon, the motive for developing eco-teams came from an idea called social diffusion. This is a model based on how ideas and innovations spread through a community from neighbor to neighbor. Gershon says this kind of interest, combined with a good cost-benefit analysis, is intriguing to municipalities, who are often running under tight budgets.
We meet with municipalities, and a number of municipalities are now underwriting the program to achieve greater participation in their already existing programs, to achieve the goals of averting the need for a new landfill or keeping the amount of waste they have to transport to a landfill less, or reducing the number of times they have to pick up waste each week. Maybe averting the need to build a new water treatment facility or a new reservoir or what have you.
For the household eco team, lifestyle changes may include bringing reusable cloth bags to stores or boosting the energy efficiency of home appliances. Simple actions like these are easy to do and inexpensive. And when multiplied by thousands or even millions of people, Gershon says the results are profound for the environment and the economy. One of the earliest pilot programs began in Bend, Oregon, where Michael Keller runs the EcoTeam program and is a member of the Central Oregon Environmental Center. He says EcoTeams are a drop in the bucket theory, but drip by drip, the bucket eventually gets full. Yet some may ask, is it really worth the investment? According to Keller, it's not a matter of twisting people's arms. The motivation is already there, and the EcoTeam is simply a reinforcer. The only challenge, he says, has been convincing funders.
Funders are often very conservative, and the EcoTeam program is a novel, innovative approach that really is behaviorally based. And there haven't been a lot of behaviorally based programs that have been out there. There's a lot of education programs, but education becomes sometimes very didactic and one-way street, where you know someone gives out information and someone in theory is a recipient, and then they're supposed to take that action and implement it. But what was missing was all the other factors that get us excited about doing something in our own lives. So this now not only provides information, but it also provides the motivation and the support necessary to get it done.
Municipalities are, however, taking notice. EcoTeam liaison Jeff Golden is the water policy aide for the Office of Public Utilities in Portland, Oregon. He says although the EcoTeam there is only a year old, the city is already noticing cost savings.
We're growing fast here in Portland, and there will come a time when we have to expand our water system. We're in the middle, we're at the beginning now of a major overhaul of our sewage system to stop raw sewage outflows into our rivers. And obviously that is driven by the demand of our citizens for those services. And as those demands decrease, we can either scale back our capital projects or defer them further into the future.
To date, about 10,000 adults have participated in an EcoTeam program. A children's version is also available called Journey for the Planet. For more information about how you can join an EcoTeam, call Global Action Plan in Woodstock, New York at 914-679-4830. That's 914-679-4830. Or search for them on Global Action Plan on the World Wide Web. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephanie Goichman.
Summer, in city parks and in subdivisions in the suburbs is punctuated by the sound of the lawnmower. If we took all of the lawns in the United States and put them together in one piece, they'd cover an area the size of the state of Wisconsin or Indiana. People who are fortunate enough to have a house with a yard spend huge amounts of time and energy dumping fertilizer, weed killers, and pesticides on their lawns and then cutting the grass. A growing band of folk concerned about increasing wildlife and limiting human impacts on natural systems say most lawns don't make any sense. They're concerned about what Bob Gracie, assistant professor for landscape architecture at the University of Michigan, says is an effort to control nature rather than live with it.
What I would mean by lawn mania is that we seem to have an obsession in our culture with maintaining lawns, irregardless of what the environmental costs would be, and that we see it as a way of treating sort of every square inch of yard space and a lot of public open spaces, as opposed to alternatives that would encourage much more of the native vegetation. And then as a sideline to that, we get caught in this trap of being very dependent on lawnmowers, of watering cycles, fertilization cycles, and all those kinds of things.
Brett Rappaport, an attorney and president of Wild Ones Natural Landscapers Limited, says the alternative to lawns is natural landscaping.
We have choices to make when we landscape. We can choose the plants that we landscape with. We can choose plants that are exotic, that is not from the region in which we live. For example, tulips, lawns, and other common garden flowers are not native to certain parts of America. As a result, in order to get them to grow, you must change the landscape and provide them with water or fertilizers or pesticides or herbicides in order to get them to grow where they are not accustomed to growing. The choice that natural landscapers make is, rather than trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, is to take plants that are native to the area in which they live and grow those.
Rappaport found that when folk in Chicago tried to establish natural prairie plots, the city wanted to prosecute them under Chicago's weed law, an old statute which forbid property owners from permitting weeds over 10 inches high to grow on their lots or in their yards. Rappaport went to court.
We filed a lawsuit under the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which states no person shall be denied of due process of law. One of the elements of due process is that a law cannot be vague. And the best example of that would be if you have a speed limit sign that says, don't go too fast. That would be vague because your too fast is different than my too fast. The same concept applies to weed laws. We took the position that the term weed is a subjective term. One man's weed is another man's rose. And we argued that, therefore, the ordinance should be struck down as unconstitutional.
Rappaport's attack exemplifies legal efforts of natural landscapers all over the United States, which have nullified or prevented enforcement of weed laws. While natural landscaping will reduce the use of fertilizers and chemicals, Sarah Stein, author of Noah's Garden, Restoring the Ecology of Our Own Backyards, says it is also important because we need to be connected with nature around us and to stop planting the same flowers and shrubs around every subdivision, no matter where it is located.
I'd like to see our localities take back their identity and have the feel of what the landscape ought to be. I think it's very important to our sense of place.
While advocates of natural landscaping may be gaining converts, putting chemicals on lawns and cutting them is a huge business. Roger Yeary is Vice President for Health, Safety, and Environmental Stewardship for the parent company of True Green ChemLawn, the largest lawn care company in the country. They do business in 47 states and have 1,800,000 customers. He agrees that in some cases, natural landscaping may be preferable, but generally, he says, lawns have aesthetic appeal, reduce rodent habitat, provide security, and reduce fire risk. Chemical treatment is key to True Green ChemLawn's program.
Well, the primary basis for lawn care is to provide plant nutrients. And so fertilization is the basic building block that we provide for lawns, and we do that at each service application. Pesticides are an adjunct to that and are only used either on a seasonal basis or on an as-needed basis.
An alternative to the consequences of lawn mania is offered by the National Wildlife Federation, which is running a campaign to convince property owners to plant things in their backyards to attract and feed wildlife. Craig Tufts is the chief naturalist for the Federation.
But we suggest that you gradually eliminate lawn. Most of us probably start off with something like, I would think, 70 to 80% of the landmass that we own or rent outside of the building itself in lawn. And maybe a realistic goal over a five-year period would be cutting it back to maybe only 30% of the total landscape. So we can put in island beds, we can put in meadow, we can develop gardens that we can use to feed our families and friends with, vegetable gardens. So there's a lot of alternatives to lawn, and they can be aesthetically attractive, they can be wildlife habitat enhancing. So there's an awful lot of opportunities out there, Peter.
You can join the National Wildlife Federation program and turn your yard into a certified wildlife habitat. As you get behind your lawnmower this weekend and you regret that birdsong is drowned out by engine noise, there is an alternative. It's called natural landscaping. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, a special rodent in the deserts of Arizona and New Mexico, called the banner-tailed kangaroo rat, is busy giving birth, collecting seeds, and beating its feet on the ground. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally explains.
Across the deserts of New Mexico, Arizona, and northern Mexico, large mounds dot the landscape. Inside them, the language of banner-tailed kangaroo rats are being deciphered. This time of year, the young are about to leave home as the rats gear up for harvesting the summer's bounty.
It's about time for the young to start to disperse. So in Arizona, there's also a summer rainy season. And if the rains are abundant and they're good annuals, they will soon begin in September then harvesting the seeds from this rainfall, which is their main food source.
Jan Randall is a biology professor at San Francisco State University. She's done pioneering work on the banner tails, having discovered their unique form of communication.
And the banner tail kangaroo rat, it has the most developed foot drumming communication system of any species that I know of. And what they do is they foot drum individually distinct signatures, so that each animal has its own distinct foot drumming signature that it can drum in the desert night and its neighbor can recognize as being a particular individual living next door. They have kind of a rhythm. They go burp, 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 and those would be short foot rolls. And then an animal may go burp, burp, burp. So this would be somewhat like what the difference would be. And as I get to know individual animals in the field at night, I can actually identify by my own ear sometimes.
The banner tails communicate to identify each other when competing during mating season and to ward off predators. They, along with half of the mammal species on Earth, are rodents. But these rats have their own family and are found exclusively in the southwestern U.S. and adjacent areas in Mexico. Foot drumming, though, is common in species around the world, but remains largely unstudied. Besides foot drumming, banner tails are also believed to be so-called keystone species. Bill Van Pelt is with the Arizona Game and Fish Department.
By eliminating kangaroo rats from an area, the plant species will change due to their seed collection. They collect specific seeds to feed upon, and by removing these animals, a different biotic community comes into the system.
So if you're in the desert one night and you want to communicate, forget about talking. Try drumming instead.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 342. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, Stephanie Goichman provided additional production support, and Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.